Right now, there are two big contests taking place in America, the presidential election and the playoffs. And if you live in Chicago, you're excused for going, the presidential
second
what?
One out, Addison Russell, the batter. And a high fly ball, deep left field, that is gone!
For the first time in 250 years, the Chicago Cubs have a shot at the World Series. Okay, it's 108, but whatever. We're going to talk about both of these contests, the election and the World Series, with a guy who's uniquely qualified to do that. David Axelrod has been a political strategist for decades. He's best known as the chief strategist of Barack Obama's campaign and served as a senior advisor in the White House after his election. And Axelrod just made his debut, this might be more important, as a New Yorker contributor with a profile of the Chicago Cubs general manager, Theo Epstein. David, let's talk about first things first, the most important thing in your life now. You are the Chicago Cubs correspondent for NewYorker.com.
Yes, and proud to be.
And thank you for that. Are the Cubs going all the way? That's all I want to know.
You know, when I talked to Theo Epstein in the spring, and I had this long conversation with him that was just a tutorial on baseball, he said, you know, all you can do is build a team that will get to the playoffs almost every year. And one of those years, you're going to win the World Series. It feels like this is the year. And I hope it is because they're pitching. They've got a great pitching staff. But, you know, Chicagoans have been trained over 108 barren years to be a little bit skeptical.
But you know, you don't get to have that anymore. That gets erased. It's like Bostonians, after
right.
they won the series, I don't want to hear about it from them anymore.
Well, I think that's fair.
So, David, there's this other contest going on, apparently, a mm-hmm. presidential one. And you've written this. Barbaric and sometimes ridiculous as this process of running for president can be, the thing that I love about it is that at the end of the day, you can't hide who you are.
Yes.
What are you finding out about Hillary Clinton that you didn't know already?
You know, I knew Hillary Clinton very well. I mean, I worked for her when she ran for the Senate in 2000. I worked against her when I worked for Barack Obama in 2008. And then I worked with her when she was Secretary of State. And I've seen everything that that I know about her. She's tenacious. She's smart. She's incredibly guarded. You know,
you wrote a pretty angry tweet that I can't imagine the Clinton campaign was too thrilled about after her health scare when
right.
she had pneumonia briefly.
Yes. I was upset because, you know, her problem with voters is not health, it's stealth. It's this notion that she is not revealing enough, and to try and hide the fact that she was ill and for 6 hours not disclose what the situation was, I thought was foolish and reckless in the midst of a campaign in which this was clearly the issue. You know, and I know exactly what happened. She was being goaded by Donald Trump and Rudy Giuliani about her
stamina
health.
Stamina.
Which is ridiculous because Hillary Clinton, as we saw in the debate, I mean, Donald Trump was spent by the end of that debate, and she was as game as could be. She is a tenacious and indefatigable person.
What do you think a second debate is going to bring out in Donald Trump? Clearly, he has to know at some level, even Donald Trump with his capacity for denial and enormous ego and all the rest, he has to know, and he's been told, that he lost. And that he ran out of gas, and that he was erratic, and all the rest in the second.
Well,
debate.
and that he paid a price for not preparing. I mean, you know, I had concluded going into the first debate that he will either emerge as the most talented politician in American history, or he'll pay the price for not prepping. Because in my experience, you cannot go into as pressure-filled an event as a presidential debate in the finals and not have prepared for it. Part of the lesson, you know, his people say, well, you know, he's not like one to dive into briefing books and stuff. Well, you know what? I got news for him. When you're president, you kind of have to do that.
And he goes with his gut.
The problem he has is, I mean, first of all, he is reacting a little bit like I expected that he would, because after the conventions, when she had such a good convention, and he was attacked in ways that obviously provoked him. He went into this tailspin, you know, sort of paroxysms of, you know, invective against the Khans and everyone else. And, you know, he's sort of come out of this a little bit like that. He's on the attack.
And yet for the 6 weeks prior to the debate, he was on an incredible road, narrowing the gap.
Because after that tailspin, he changed his management. And he made some changes, the biggest of which was that he started making speeches off of teleprompters, something that he hadn't done before. His people told me before the debate, well, this was going to help him in the debate because he doesn't really, you know, review stuff that well. But the speeches he paid attention to, so maybe he would absorb that. This next debate is a town hall debate. You're going to have a theater full of citizens who are there to interact with the candidate and ask questions.
How does that change the dynamic?
Very much, because these people are going to, and the audience, the television audience, are going to recoil if instead of addressing the people there about their problems, he goes on the attack about, you know, Bill Clinton's infidelities.
Is that a bad idea?
To go
after the infidelity?
I think it is. I mean, I understand the theory behind it is that he's going to go after her for her treatment of the women involved.
Yeah.
But I think that she can very easily flip that. You know, everybody knows she went through a really difficult time, and she did, after all, fight to keep her marriage together,
which is not uncommon.
Right.
As a characteristic of many people's marriages.
But it is uncommon for Donald Trump.
Now, I think I can imagine, I don't want to presume anything about our audience, but I have to imagine that a lot of public radio listeners still can't quite figure out how this happened. How Donald Trump, who had been a kind of figure on the New York jokescape in the 80s, a guy who almost played a cartoon role made for Spy magazine, made for then Jon Stewart, who seemed to be in on the joke of himself as a means of making money, suddenly turns around, surprises the commentariat by...
And maybe himself.
And maybe himself by running for president. Now he is within spitting distance of the nuclear codes.
Yes.
How did this happen, David?
Well, I think the fact that so many of your listeners are surprised by it speaks to something, which is that we have a great chasm in our country. Here in New York City, there are a lot of winners. In other places, there are a lot of people who didn't win, who saw jobs that paid a good middle-class wage.
But these are trends, in fairness, these are trends that have been going on for quite a long time.
And this has been building for quite a long time. I mean, remember, Bill Clinton ran for president in 1992 talking about the forgotten middle class. You know, I think it's built over time. I think there are other elements. E.J. Dionne wrote a book about the conservative movement recently, and he said, you know, part of it was that the conservatives kept promising people that, you know, we're going to turn back Obamacare, we're going to do and this, and none of it happened. And so this radicalized the right against their own. But I will say this, I was around in 2008 when Sarah Palin was the vice presidential nominee, and I remember John McCain confronting people at his own rally in Minnesota. I think it was the high point of his campaign. It was incredibly...
A woman would come up and say,
I'm scared. Yeah. He's not an American. He's a Muslim.
And he'd say, wait a minute.
Right. He said, no, he's a fine person.
And a patriot.
Just have disagreements with him. I thought that was John McCain's finest moment, and I'll always remember it. But the point is, the people who showed up at those rallies are the people who are now, you know, the core of Donald Trump's support. And he is a genius at surfing their alienation. You know, the wall, the Muslim ban, you know, you have trouble and it's because of them and we're going to stop it.
But isn't it amazing that this is rhetoric coming from a Manhattan real estate guy?
Yeah, but a Manhattan real estate guy who's been in the homes of middle America for 14 years as host of The Apprentice, where he is portrayed as the omniscient, you know, businessman who knows how to run things, because that's the other element of it. So I wrote a column for the Times earlier this year about the fact that I believe that there is a replica remedy kind of dynamic in succession elections for president, where the president who's leaving sets the tone, and people never choose the replica of what they have, even if the president's popular. They always choose the remedy.
That's her biggest problem, isn't it?
It is, yeah, in a way.
She's seen as more of the same.
Well, that's true in the sense, I'm talking in these nonlinear ways, like style and approach. Barack Obama was a departure from George Bush on policy for sure, but he also was a sharp departure from George Bush
stylistically.
There's no one who represents a sharper departure from Barack Obama.
In other words, that's that famous night, maybe you were there, you probably were there, White House Correspondents' Dinner, and the president gets up and just tears Donald Trump's head off. And I was I'm a table away. For my sins. And there you could see steam, at least metaphorically, rising off the shoulders and an orange head of Donald Trump. And now a lot of people think, that's the creation myth. That's the moment that Donald Trump decided, I am going to get back at this son of a bitch.
I have to tell you that I don't think that Donald Trump's ambitions needed
stoking.
Any torquing up. I think that he, you know, he'd been talking about running for president, you know, for years. But I think what he...
But did you think that was a joke, a kind of marketing exercise?
Well, I don't know. I can't climb into the head of Donald Trump. But the point is, it wasn't a new ambition for him. And I think he found in the birther movement, the reaction he got was something that encouraged him to think that he could pull this off. He got a feel for the wrath that was out there that he could exploit.
I remember interviewing the president about race years ago. You were still in the White House, and the discussion was interesting, but there was a formality to it.
Yes.
And then it ended, and then the president went down the hall, and then he turned around, and he came back, and he said, look, I got to tell you, discussing these things is really complicated. This is years ago. Really difficult. I say a stray word, and it moves markets, as it were, in the same way that you can affect the stock market with a stray word. Years have gone by now. We've seen one horrible incident after another, and the incidents obviously paint a picture that these are not incidents. This is a pattern. This is a way of life in terms of what it is to be African-American in this country. And the president's language about this has evolved, and yet he's going to leave office, I think, on these issues with a deep sense of pain and ambivalence as well as some sense of historical accomplishment. How do you view it?
Well, first of all, you get this question all the time, are we worse off now? And the answer is no, we're not worse off. We're just having a more honest discussion. David, when I was a young journalist, one of my first jobs was as a political columnist at the Hyde Park Herald. I was 18 years old when I started writing political columns there. The first column I ever wrote in Chicago in December of 1973 was about the clash between Mayor Richard J. Daley and Ralph Metcalf, who was a congressman on the south side of Chicago, over police brutality. And it was a defining issue of that time. The difference today is that everyone has a cell phone, and now all of America can see what the experience of African Americans has been for generations. That doesn't mean that the problem is worse. It means that we now are more focused on it because people can see it, and it's out in the open. And in certain ways, having the first African-American president has surfaced some things that have always been there because race has been central to our story in a very painful way from the beginning of the Republic. So I don't think that our problems are worse, but our problems are more evident.
But tell me from the inside, as a confidant of the president, somebody really close to him, about how he approached talking about this from the start. Because it begins, in a sense, with the he wanted to make a race speech long before he made it.
Right.
And people around him, maybe you, were very reluctant to have this speech made.
Because he was running for president of the United States.
And I think the line was from the campaign, they already know you're black.
Right.
In other words, you don't need to make a race speech. And it was a speech born of necessity and Jeremiah Wright and all
exactly.
the rest. Tell me about his thinking, and as you see it, on the evolution.
I think that there are a couple of things. One is, you know, the moment at which we arrived at the White House, we didn't have sort of options about how to prioritize how he would spend his political capital because we had an epic crisis.
Yeah.
You know, a serial crisis, that had to be the focus. The second thing was he was always conscious, we were always conscious of, he was always an African-American man who was running for president of the United States, not a man running to be the first black president. He didn't want to be limited that way. But, you know, I saw things happen that would not have happened to another president. No other president would have had his very citizenship question in the way it was. No other president would have had a member of Congress stand up and shout, "You lie," in the chambers. Through all the vituperative history of the Republic, we've never seen that until now. So obviously, race has been part of the story, but we never wanted to be in a position where it appeared as if he was saying, I should be treated differently. Even though he was being treated differently, we didn't want to look like we were creating excuses for what people perceived as shortcomings in our administration, saying I should be judged differently. I mean, and it was a very difficult line to walk, and at times an untenable line to walk.
Do you think he becomes an ex-president on January 20th?
Yes.
And probably one of the first things he'll do is sign a book contract and begin to write it.
I would think so, yeah.
Do you think that we will ever really know the full extent of the what it's like to be that guy, the feeling when it comes to moments like
this? I hope so. You know,
because those books are generally terrible and stinting.
Well, I will tell you that I expect that he's going to write one of the great presidential autobiographies ever, because he is a writer. And one of the things that I've always noticed about him is that he's always in the scene but watching the scene. He's very observant about people. And, you know, you saw in Dreams from My Father that he has the ability also through his writing to probe himself. And I expect that he will confront those issues in his book, and we'll learn what it was like to be him, you know, essentially the Jackie Robinson of politics, as it were, breaking this barrier and the pressures that were associated with that. But I just have to say, I have to take a moment just to say how proud I am of how he's conducted himself. I don't think anybody's, probably since Roosevelt, had experienced quite a term or two terms like this, given what we confronted coming in. And you add this element that we're talking about, and the fact that he's been a real role model, and I don't mean just for African Americans, but for the whole country and his family as well. Quite apart from everything that he's achieved, he's an admirable human being, and I think people have come to that conclusion.
David, thank you.
Great to be with you.
Good to see you. David Axelrod. He's the director of the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago.